It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. This week marks the launch of 90.5 WESA's new technology and culture podcast, Nanograms, Brief Messages from the Very Near Future, is produced by Morning Edition host Josh Rollerson, who joins us now. Josh Rollerson, welcome back to Essential Pittsburgh.
Hey, thanks for having me, Paul.
So what is Nanograms?
Nanograms is a podcast that I developed kind of over the course of the last year, the idea being to take sort of big, complicated topics generally relating to technology in some way and the sort of intersection between technology and culture, so broadly defined, but to take some particular angle to that subject and then break it up into a series of shorter pieces. So nanograms, literally very short, tiny little messages from the very near future, as the tagline has it. So this is a series of interrelated pieces, and the first season of which, and the hope is that this will just be organized by seasons going forward. You'll have a run of episodes on a topic. The first one of which is cyborg law and public policy, which I can explain a little bit later.
Okay, well, I'd like to talk about the project and how it came about, but first, let's hear a little bit of the show. I understand that you have a preview.
Right, yeah, this will be just the very opening of the very first episode. It's designed to be introductory, so hopefully requires no further explanation.
Nanograms, brief messages from the very near future.
It's not exactly a new observation. Mobile devices have become indispensable tools for modern life.
Calls, texts, Pinterest, and searching the web.
Pictures, texting, Pinterest.
Games, Facebook,
Chrome, Gmail.
Directions, lots of directions.
But have you noticed how dependent we've become?
Calling, texting, boredom.
Twitter, social media,
lots of Instagram.
At least 6 hours a day.
Music, I use Pandora a lot.
I would die without Pandora.
In the U.S., about two-thirds of us now own a smartphone, and for most of us, it's not just a tool anymore. It's almost like a new body part.
Everything's in there. My schedule, reminders, my life. Yeah. My life.
Our smartphones are, they might as well be part of our anatomy. It's something quite literally you carry on your person at all times.
That's no exaggeration. More than 80% of U.S. smartphone users now keep their phones on them throughout the day. And most of us have them within reach even while we're sleeping. This behavior has gotten to be so pervasive that it's actually changing our concept of self, the boundary we draw between the individual and her environment. That may sound a little out there, but it's not coming from me. It's actually from a little outfit called the U.S. Supreme Court.
If we're saying, for example, that the person should not be monitored in a certain way, but your technology is open to monitoring, then what we're seeing is a legal fiction of sorts if we don't recognize the connection between, you know, a person and their smartphone.
I'm Josh Rollerson, and this is Nanograms.
An excerpt from the first episode of Nanograms, 90.5 WESA's new original podcast created by Josh Rollerson. Season one begins Thursday. It's titled Borg in the USA. That's Borg as in cyborg?
Right, right. So cyborg, a human-machine combination, and something people are probably most used to thinking of in a context of science fiction movies and TV shows and the like. Another context in which this term gets used is a sort of a social theory and critical theory. It's the idea that mobile and wearable devices have become so prevalent, so much integrated with the way we live nowadays, that it's not really that much of a stretch to say that we're a new kind of human beings that haven't existed before, a new kind of subject, a new way of being in the world that is engendered and made possible by the very intimate relationships we have with mobile devices. So, I mean, most obviously phones, but this extends to wearable like fitness trackers and various consumer biometric devices that are getting more popular lately. So this is not a new idea. It's been, you know, thrown around in sort of academic circles for a while, but only recently has been ratified by the U.S. Supreme Court in a historic ruling pretty recently. And that was kind of the genesis of this this idea.
You're talking about the decision in Riley versus California last year when the court ruled that the Fourth Amendment prohibition against unreasonable search and seizure applies to information stored on cell phones.
Right, exactly. That was this really really key ruling that came down last year from the Supreme Court in which they determined Police make a traffic stop. They can search, you know, your vehicle or your person for a weapon or something that, you know, that a police officer would need to know about for his own safety, his or her own safety. The question was, does that extend to what may be on a suspect's cell phone? Do the police have the right to also search that? And the answer was no. And the reason given by the court, the majority, was that our cell phones are our new kind of category. And in fact, really, in a very real sense, kind of like a new part of our anatomy. And that's more or less a direct quote from John Roberts, who's not the kind of you usually think of sort of Elon Musk, Ray Kurzweil kind of futurist, wild-eyed thinkers, visionaries. John Roberts is not the kind of guy that you expect that kind of an idea from. But
no,
nevertheless,
not necessarily. And the thought occurs to me, or the question occurs to me, how many people, it would have to be a very small percentage now, walking the streets that do not have some sort of device on
right.
their person? I'm guessing that the ones who don't are less than 5%, and that's probably even a conservative estimate.
At my last check, it's something like 2/3 of us own one, and a little bit over half of us have it when we're asleep, so by the bed at night, so within reach at all times. So it's not really an exaggeration, and it's something that the court felt that needed to be accounted for in the law. So that was the basis for some interesting reporting at the time, and then that led to a fascinating paper that the Brookings Institution put out last year about this time, kind of exploring that idea. So that's where I began with this project. I interviewed one of the authors of that paper, whose voice you just heard. Her name is Jane Chong, and you'll hear a lot of her in the series. So I spoke with her and learned more about her thinking and how this idea has already begun to play out in case law and other arenas already. And so I got interested in thinking about how this may play out in other spaces.
And this is all pretty abstract.
Definitely, it is. It is and it isn't. Because obviously, you know, to say you have a cell phone, you don't literally have a new body part. No matter how often you may have it with you, it's not embedded physically in your body yet.
Although it seems yeah. it seems to be.
It
went with the way people wear their Bluetooth devices, for example.
Sure. So it's kind of this fuzzy boundary. And that was, that's another point that the majority decision makes, in fact, that if you were an alien from space and you'd never observed human beings before, you could easily be led to believe that this is part of the anatomy. But yes, we're not talking about physical augmentations for the most part, except that there are people who are physically augmenting their bodies in much more literal ways. And some of them are doing it because they see themselves as part of a movement, a sort of transhumanist movement. And I spoke to some of those people, and you'll hear from them later on. There are other people that are not, they don't self-identify as cyborgs, but nevertheless, they have artificial components in their body that are very important for their health and survival that put them in a very different category from the rest of us.
Which brings us to the next clip.
Right. So to set this one up, I spoke with Dr. Sandeep Jain, who's a cardiac electrophysiologist with UPMC, and that just means his job is installing pacemakers and implantable defibrillators and other devices that help people's hearts keep moving. So it's hard to imagine something more intimate. And what I found out was that the current generation of these devices, in fact, for a little while now, have had this wireless capability where they send information, diagnostic information, both about what your heart is doing and also what the device is doing, out wirelessly over the internet. It goes to these remote monitoring centers where there are people watching what's going on in your heart kind of all the time. So I started by asking Dr. Jain about that, and you'll hear what he had to say.
Patients have a device that hooks up to their phone line and can even be done wirelessly, that then wirelessly is talking to their pacemaker. And that device, and the diagnostics that the device is keeping up with all along the way, every day even, can be transmitted to their caring center. And we have a whole team of people that are monitoring these devices remotely that can give us red flags and alerts that then can prompt earlier intervention.
Okay, stop right there. Let's just take a moment to appreciate the profound postmodern weirdness of this situation. if you have one of these devices in your body, it means you're constantly beaming information to a little base station that sits on a bookshelf, say, or a nightstand. And it's just one of however many wireless devices you may have in your home. Tablets, video streaming boxes, smart appliances, and so on. Ever heard of the Internet of Things? You're part of it now. And every moment of your life, your heartbeat is echoing across the Internet. While you sleep, there's a room full of people in a data center somewhere. And that could be anywhere. Seattle, Dallas, Dubai, maybe. Who knows? These are people you'll never meet, all of whom are listening intently, 24/7, from thousands of miles away, to the beating of your heart. Observing its rhythm, graphing it, and studying the graphs. Measuring the electrical impedance of your body mass while you're watching TV or in the shower. Now, it's possible to imagine this scenario being either unnerving or perhaps kind of comforting for different people. But let me take you back to that last part of what Dr. Jan said, the part about red flags and early interventions.
The other types of information that are being looked at on trial basis are looking at impending heart attacks or blockages in the heart from electrical activity within the heart. That could a pacemaker or defibrillator give us an idea that a blockage may be coming before a patient experiences chest discomfort and alert us to that.
How far ahead could you possibly predict something like that?
So that's a great question and ongoing, but maybe even on the order of hours.
So not only can your remote monitoring team observe your most intimate and essential biological functions in real time, in some cases, they might even be able to see into your future, to see your heart attack coming minutes or maybe even hours before you can. But you, the person who's about to have the heart attack, will be the last to know.
It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. 90.5 WESA's Josh Rollerson is our guest. We've been listening to some highlights from his new podcast, Nanograms, which starts this week. We just heard about how implanted medical devices feed biometric data to remote monitoring centers. How does that connect with the idea of cyborg law?
Right. It connects in this case in that there are people who call themselves pacemaker activists. This is a subset of the cyborg activist community, which is also a real thing, as we'll learn. One man in particular, his name is Hugo Campos, and he's just a guy. He has a pacemaker, or I suppose it's an implantable defibrillator, that keeps him alive. He happens to be sort of a self-quantifier. He's interested in, you know, studying his health, keeps track of what he eats and when and how that affects him. And he had something happened with his heart, and he needed to get this device implanted. And naturally, he became interested in, what information he could get from that device and how he could make decisions that would keep him healthier. The problem is that information is proprietary, and the manufacturer of the device does not let, you know, the patient, the user who has this chunk of metal and plastic in their literal heart, can't access the information on it. So this guy's been fighting in the courts over that. So you can see,
interesting story.
It's crazy. You can see how this ties in with larger debates that we've been hearing more and more about intellectual property and copyright and user access to data. But it puts it in this, you know, really urgent kind of life or death context. And, you know, I'm sort of using this example to dramatize it, but it also ties into, I think, things that we're going to hear more about as wearable fitness devices become more and more prevalent.
How did you get interested in this?
This kind of ties in with my academic background. I spent a lot of time studying futurist discourse and science fiction, something that's always interested in me. And so I'm interested in technology and how it's changing. But in particular, I've always been interested in how that gets represented culturally and how that tends to script the way that we understand what's happening around us as we, you know, continually move into the future. Our attitudes and our ideas about what's happening with technology and how we relate to it is very much prefigured by the culture that we've consumed. So cyborg seemed like a really interesting jumping off point for that. The idea that people have a notion of the cyborg, but in fact, it is becoming a very literal presence. So how do you negotiate the distance between those two? How this particular project got started with was with an interview with Jane Chong, one of these Brookings researchers who had published this paper last year, who really furnished a lot of the material. The more I talked to her, the more I thought it was going to be a radio story initially, and then I thought, well, this needs to be a standalone interview. But that got a little too long, and so it turned into a series. And then eventually, it became clear that this was never going to fit into the holes that we have available to us in radio with the format clock that we have to work within. So it seemed like a really natural project to use to explore, podcasting, which is something that we've been talking about here at WESA. How can we expand our program offerings in a way that, that makes sense with the subject matter and that lets us do some new things that we haven't been able to?
What would you say to somebody who's new to podcasts or maybe a little skeptical?
Right, yeah. I think there's still kind of a misconception, even though podcasting listenership is growing really fast. It's been very eye-opening in our industry. There's a lot of conversations happening around podcasting. Nevertheless, there's some resistance that I think has to do with this idea that the technology is a little bit inaccessible or difficult. I think there's some resistance, very understandable resistance to the idea that I might have to download some app and create an account and remember another password and all that stuff. So what I would say to anybody that has that attitude is it's really a lot easier than you think. A podcast is simply an audio program that you get online, and that doesn't necessarily have to entail an iPhone or anything like that. You can listen to this show on your computer, your desktop browser. We've got a really cool website that we built out with this specifically in mind. It's responsive design, which means it shows up on whatever device you're using in a way that makes it very seamless. And we've got a player built into the site, so you'll be able to just play it from there. You don't have to install anything. It's very, very easy, and I hope just really frictionless. So give it a try.
Yeah, it sounds interesting. And the website is?
Website is nanograms.org, O-R-G. The first episode is going to be up this Thursday, and we're working on getting it connected to all the various other podcast curation distribution platforms. So it is should be on iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn, all those places, SoundCloud, I think. So we got 7 episodes in the can. We are doing a launch event on Thursday, the same day that the episodes come out. That is going to be recorded. So hopefully that will become the 8th episode, kind of a summation of this series. But starting this week, we're going to roll them out every Thursday, and that takes us up through mid-November, at which point hopefully I'll have a start on the next season. So hopefully look for that next year.
Josh Rollerson, 90.5 WESA's Morning Edition host, talking about his new podcast, Nanograms, which starts this week. Josh Rollerson, thank you so much for joining us on Essential Pittsburgh.
Thanks, Paul.
And thank you for listening to Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. If you missed any portion of our program or would like to revisit past segments, you can go to our website at wesa.fm. Until tomorrow, I'm Paul Guggenheimer. So long for now.